the greatest century of missions. History tells us what has worked and what has not worked. We need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. And so the 19th century became the greatest century of missions. As the people were singing, "Let the earth hear his voice." The 19th century, from 1801 to 1900, was the greatest century of missions. And if we want the 21st century to be the greatest century of missions and revival, then we will need to learn from those Christian pioneers whom God used to make the 19th century the greatest century of Christian advance so far. In 1801, Protestant Christianity was concentrated in Europe and in North America. Except for a few small Christian enclaves, Asia was almost untouched by the gospel. There were some significant Christian communities in Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and a small number of Dutch settlers at the southernmost tip of Africa, but otherwise Africa was unevangelized. However, by the end of the 1800s, Christianity was a world religion with churches established in almost every country on earth. How Christianity came to be the first truly international religion in just one century is an amazing story. What inspired these incredibly effective missionary pioneers and the successful strategies they employed needs to be carefully and prayerfully examined if we are to be more effective in world evangelization. While the 20th century can boast greater numbers of missionaries in the field and greater numbers of converts, the 19th century saw far greater depth of impact for the gospel. And I can contrast this because I was a participant at the greatest missions conference in the history of the world, which was Cape Town, 2010. Lausanne 3, held in Cape Town, 2010. We had 4,200 delegates, participants, from 197 countries. The most representative international missions conference in history. And it was on the 100th anniversary of the first World Missions Conference in Edinburgh. And I tell you the contrast between the 19th century missionary movement and the 20th century missionary movement was between these two conferences. In 1910, the Church Missions Conference in Edinburgh was anticipating the fulfillment of the Great Commission by 1960. The extinction of Islam, Buddhism, and all false religions by 1960, the year I was born. They were anticipating the fulfillment of the Great Commission, the evangelization, discipleship of the whole world, and perhaps the biblical millennium could begin before the end of the 20th century. That was the consensus, the general opinion of most of the delegates, all of the delegates and speakers, in the 1910 World Missions Conference in Edinburgh. But when I went to Cape Town 2010, it was sad to think how far we've fallen. We've got more numbers, but our depth of impact has plummeted. Especially when we consider the very limited resources available to these pioneers and the overwhelming difficulties and dangers and obstacles which they had to overcome. The missionary pioneers in the 19th century clearly present the most inspiring examples of Christian courage and perseverance against all odds. The incredible adventures of these soul winners, these nation builders, these culture shapers, makes for exhilarating reading. The exploits and achievements of these extraordinary Christian heroes and heroines have been mostly forgotten in the countries where they were sent out from. For this reason, it's perhaps appropriate that this book, The Greatest Century of Missions, celebrating some of the achievements and adventures and sacrifices of these missionary pioneers, comes from Africa. For it is we in Africa who have benefited so greatly from the 19th century missionary movement. In this time of secularization and skepticism, you may be surprised to hear how much these missionary pioneers are honored in Africa. Last year we celebrated the Livingston 200, 200th anniversary of the birth of Dr. David Livingston, the best friend Africa ever had. Dr. David Livingston has had two towns in Africa named after him, Livingston in Zambia, where we had this Livingston 200 Missions Conference last year, and Livingstonia in Malawi. Other towns in Africa that were named after Europeans like Stanleyville, Salisbury, Elizabethville, Fort Victoria, they've had their names changed. But Livingston and Livingstonia remain, as a tribute to a man who brought faith to the hearts of Africans, but he struck fear in the hearts of the Arab slave traders. Livingstone is known as a liberator in Africa. And while statues of many colonial figures like Cecil John Rhodes have been toppled, monuments and statues to missionary pioneers like David Livingstone retain their prominence and reflect a deep respect which Africans still have for these missionary pioneers. In fact, they're still building new statues to Livingstone in Zambia. I came across 8 statues to Livingstone just in Livingstone, the town of Livingstone. Even at the airport, they've just opened up a new one. There have, of course, been many concerted attempts to discredit the memory of these early missionaries. Karl Marx declared the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. From the time I was first converted to Christ in 1977, I have heard the most vicious slanders against the 19th century missionary movement. At one of the first missions conferences I ever attended, a missiology professor from Stellenbosch University, Dr. Nico Smith, declared the missionaries did not believe that black people had souls. They taught that Africans were the firewood of hell. Now, at that time, I knew nothing about anything. I was a brand new convert. What did I know? But what he said sounded so outrageous, so self-contradictory. I stood up in a plenary session. I didn't realize that that was totally unacceptable. At a missions conference, I was about the youngest and the least, but I stood up at this missions conference and I said, which missionaries taught these things? Did David Livingstone or Robert Moffat teach this? And the professor looked a little surprised. He said, no, not them. I said, did C.T. Studd believe these things? Did Mary Slessor believe these things? He began to get uncomfortable and he said, no, not them. I said, well, which missionaries taught and believed these things? Because I don't understand why anyone would come to Africa as a missionary, many of them dying of disease here in the field, if they didn't believe that the people in Africa were souls for whom Christ died. Didn't many of the missionaries die, bring the gospel to Africa? Why would they have done that? Here's the grave of Mary Moffat, Mary Livingstone, the wife of David Livingstone, buried at age 42 in Mozambique. The average missionary's life expectancy in West Africa was 2 years after arriving. The university professor looked uncomfortable and he never answered my question. He drifted off in some anecdotes about heartless church members who didn't have good relations with people of another race. Well, I wondered, what on earth does that have to do with missionaries of the 19th century who had opened up Africa for the gospel, often at the cost of their own lives? Although I didn't know much about God's law at the time, I had this uncomfortable feeling that I'd just heard someone bearing false witness against Christians of another era, our fathers of the faith, actually, who weren't present to answer this slander. It's cowardly to speak behind someone's back. Oh, you can score goals when the other team's not on the field to protect their goalposts. But that means nothing, does it? How many times you can kick a ball in the goalpost when the other team's not on the field? What does that mean? It's cowardly to make a football out of our spiritual fathers of the faith. I couldn't help wondering if these speakers really thought they would have done a better job had they been in those positions. With the few resources the missionaries of the 19th century had, facing overwhelming obstacles and dangers which they encountered, would we have even ventured into the field? Hindsight is all very well, but pioneers do not have the benefit of any hindsight of anyone who's gone before, because they are the pathfinders. There was no missionary manuals or cross-cultural training or language study courses or dictionaries of the different languages. People like William Carey and David Livingstone wrote the dictionaries. They translated scriptures. They wrote the books. No one was there to teach them on what to do. They were the first ones to go. As I ventured into the mission fields of Mozambique and Angola and Sudan, my respect for these missionaries has only increased. I was reading Livingstone's travels while retracing much of the steps in the Shiri Valley of Malawi and the Zambezi Valley of Mozambique in 1989. When I was doing primary research for what became In the Killing Fields of Mozambique book. In 1989, when I was captured by communist troops in Mozambique and flown by Russian pilots in Soviet Mi-8 HIP helicopters to Tet and later to Mashava Security Prison in Maputo, I was intrigued to see how Livingstone's description of Tet back in the 1850s could so accurately be described to Tet in 1989 as well. The devastation from the Arab slave traders, which he recorded in the Zambezi expedition, could have also described much of the scorched earth campaign of the communist Frelimo government and their Soviet allies in the 1980s. On another occasion, I was going down some of the worst roads I've ever experienced in the Shasheki area of Zambia. I remembered some of the trials and tribulations of David Livingstone in that very area. And as I regularly have to remind our young volunteers of our mission, who complain about the bad roads, David Livingstone had to walk where we drive. And he had to walk across an Africa that had no roads, no bridges, no shops, no hospitals, neither was clean drinking water available. As Livingstone reported after his first missionary journey, "I've drunk water swarming with insects, thick with mud, putrid with rhinoceros urine and buffalo dung." Hacking his way through the dense rainforest, walking for days in pouring rain, totally drenched with all of his equipment either rusting or rotting, Livingstone persevered across the continent. Hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing their territory. His life was in constant danger from Muslim slave raiders. He was mauled by a lion. He was charged by rhino. He was laid low by fever on over 60 occasions. The afflictions Livingstone was called to endure while opening up Africa for the gospel and opposing the slave trade tested the limits of human endurance. Leeches, maggots, putty flies, cholera, pneumonia, sunburn, huge sores, tropical ulcers, and malaria plagued him. Yet his indomitable spirit rose as he set his heart to accomplish goals which seemed humanly impossible. He persevered, and as a result of his sacrificial labors, the slave trade in Central and Eastern Africa was exposed and it was eradicated. Livingstone's steadfast example was used of the Lord to inspire many hundreds of men and women to devote their lives to African missions, such as Mary Slessor, for example, one of the poorest of the poor. She lived in greater poverty than even David Livingstone. She went to Calabar, present-day Nigeria. Her two older brothers were going to be missionaries to Africa, and they both died before they could get there. And when Livingstone died, she believed she had to go to take her brother's place to continue the work of Livingstone in Africa. She went to Nigeria. And Dr. Kenneth Fraser was inspired to go to Moreland in South Sudan, where he started the first school, the first hospital, the first church, trained the first nurses and chaplains and teachers in South Sudan. He was inspired by the example of David Livingstone. He is also a Scotsman. Modern detractors of the 19th century missionary movement like to brush aside the historical realities which the missionaries had to confront. They prefer to paint a picture of Africa before the gospel as idyllic and utopian. Kenneth Kaunda, the one-time dictator of Zambia, wrote in his book, A Humanist in Africa, that the people in Africa knew nothing about suffering until the missionaries arrived. His parents were dedicated Christians who had been trained in Livingstonia. He said, "I could not accept the Calvinist faith of my parents who believed in the sinfulness of man. I believe in the goodness of man." Interesting. His prisons were filled with people who hadn't had a trial, detained by someone who believed in the goodness of man. According to people like Kaunda, all Africans lived in peace, harmony, tranquility, prosperity before the missionaries arrived with the gospel and ruined everything. Now you might expect some kind of ahistoric mumblings like this from committed Marxists who hate the gospel, but incredibly all too many Christians, because of their ignorance of history, are repeating these allegations even in Christian publications. And I've heard garbage like this at missions conferences. But the reality of heathenism is far different. When Mary Slessor came to Calabar, present-day Nigeria, she was horrified to discover that a woman who gave birth to twins was regarded with horror. It was believed that the father of one of the twins must be a demon, and she is guilty of a great sin. At least one of the children must be a monster, so they killed both. They seized the twins and broke their backs. They were crushed into a calabash. taken out not by the doorway but by a hole made in the back of the wall, which was once again built up again. They were thrown in the bush where they were left to be eaten by insects or wild beasts. Mary found Calabar in the grip of rampant witchcraft, drunkenness, and immorality. She intervened to prevent a witch doctor pouring boiling oil over a woman spread-eagled on the ground. She stopped him, stood in front of the witch doctor, and saved the life of this woman. Cannibalism and slavery between the tribes was widespread. Once when instructed to heal a dying chief, Mary knew if she failed, she would be blamed for his death. First, she got rid of all the witchcraft charms and all the sacrificed chickens lying around the hut. Then she prayed and gave the chief good medicine, and she nursed him back to health. And the wives of the chief were understandably particularly grateful for Mary's success, because they would have otherwise been killed and buried with the chief if he had died. These wives were understandably keen to learn about the book. Samuel Marsden, the pioneer missionary to New Zealand, witnessed the depth of degradation and the hold of superstition over the Maori people when the widow of the deceased chief hanged herself with the approval and applause of her parents and brothers. Imagine standing by and applauding while your sister or daughter commits suicide. That's how heathenism had gripped the people, the Maori people of New Zealand. Cannibalism was rife amongst the Maori. One woman confessed she had killed and eaten 19 children. Another man said, "I have one bone for every person I've ever killed and eaten." He counted up and he had over 134 bones. He says he'd killed and eaten 134 people. Missionaries to the New Hebrides found human sacrifices and cannibalism rife throughout the Pacific Islands. In Fiji, 2/3 of all children were boiled and eaten. Every village had a human butcher. Aged parents were butchered and eaten by their children. Men would even cook their best wife or child as a special feast for their friends. John Patton, the missionary to the New Hebrides, reported on an occasion in Tana when three women were killed in a human sacrifice to secure the recovery of health for the chief. When missionary to the South Sea Islands, John Williams was criticized for imposing foreign Christian standards upon unwilling communities living in primitive bliss. He said, "These are the same communities where laziness, promiscuity, human sacrifice, and the burial alive of infants had shortly before been commonplace. These are the realities of heathenism. This is the fact of what life was like in every society before the gospel came there. Far from the missionaries interrupting the peace and the tranquility of the pagan nations, the missionaries came to nations that were passing through immense upheavals. When Hudson Taylor first landed in Shanghai in 1854, the country was being torn apart by a vicious civil war, the so-called Taiping Rebellion. Rebels held the city. 50,000 imperial troops besieged it. The house that Hudson Taylor was staying in, where he's doing his language studies, was struck by cannon fire. The house next to his was destroyed. He frequently witnessed people being beheaded. He himself came close to being lynched on many occasions. Over 25 million Chinese were killed in two civil wars. That's more than the population of most of our countries. Just in two civil wars in the 1850s and the 1860s in China. Another 10 million died between 1877 and 1879. In just 2 years, 10 million died during a famine in the north of China. This is the reality of the world before the gospel reached. As George Grant stated in his introduction to the Greatest Century Missions, as missionaries moved out from Christendom to the uttermost parts of the earth, they were shocked to discover all the horrors of untamed paganism. They found abortion all too prevalent, infanticide all too common, abandonment all too familiar, euthanasia all too customary. They were confronted by the specter of endemic poverty, reoccurring famine, unfettered disease and widespread chattel slavery. Cannibalism, ritual abuse, patricide, that's the killing of parents, human sacrifice, sexual perversity, petty tyranny, paternalistic exploitation, live burials, exterminative clan warfare, genocidal tribal vendettas all predominated. As missionaries circled the globe and penetrated the jungles and crossed the seas, they preached a singular message. Light out of darkness. Liberty out of tyranny. Life out of death. To cultures endemic with terrible poverty, brutality, lawlessness and disease, these faithful Christian witnesses interjected the novel Christian concepts of grace, charity, law, medicine, and the sanctity of life. They overturned despots. They liberated the captives. They rescued the perishing. They established hospitals. They founded orphanages. They started rescue missions. They built almshouses. They opened soup kitchens. They incorporated charitable societies. They changed laws. They demonstrated love. They lived as if people really mattered. Wherever the missionaries went, they faced a dual challenge. Confront sin in men's hearts. Confront sin in men's cultures. And the obstacles and the dangers and the difficulties that they had to face and overcome were staggering. By an act of British Parliament, all missionaries in India were illegal. In China, not only was all missionary activity illegal, but it was completely illegal to attempt to learn the Chinese language. There was a ban on any Chinese attempting to teach their language to foreigners. So the first Protestant missionary to China, Robert Morrison, his Chinese tutors carried poison on their bodies so they could quickly end their lives and escape torture if they were captured. Chinese torture is excruciating. Because at that time the Chinese forbade foreign women, Robert Morrison had to live apart from his wife Mary for most of their lives, once they were separated for 6 years in succession. Can you imagine? America's first foreign missionary, Adoniram Judson, was captured on the high seas, incarcerated in a French prison, from which he escaped. Later he was imprisoned, tortured to death in Burma for 18 months. Livingston wrote that we need to be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord might be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. A mission organization wrote to David Livingston asking, have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to send other men to join you. Livingston replied, if you have men who will come only if there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all. The challenge of David Livingston rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. C.T. Studd, the famous cricket captain turned pioneer missionary, declared, if Jesus Christ be God and if he died for me, then no sacrifice can be too great for me to make for him. As he suffered malaria and other attacks, C.T. Studd writes, some like to live within sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell. In the words of C.T. Studd, Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches, to snatch them from the very jaws of hell, to train them and enlist them for Jesus and make them a mighty army of God. But this can only be accomplished by red hot, unconventional, unfettered, Holy Spirit religion, by reckless sacrifice, by heroism in the foremost trenches. The challenge of Livingston rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owed to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. Studying the sacrifices and the exploits of pioneer missionaries in the 19th century is most challenging and inspiring. These were ordinary people made extraordinary by a dynamic and a vibrant Christian faith, which carried them through some of the worst circumstances imaginable. C.T. Studd once wrote, "I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths, but no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. Assent to creed was born again into decisive action of obedience." Hudson Taylor declared that his life was based on three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken in the Bible. He means what he says, and he will do all that he has promised. That's a good three-point sermon and a good basis to build any life. Hudson Taylor wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him and the conviction that never left him that he was called to China. Hudson Taylor agonized in prayer for China. Sometimes he was praying through the night, and he wrote of wrestling with his unbelief and how the Lord conquered my unbelief and how I surrendered myself to God for his service. The Great Commission is not an option to be considered. It is a command to be obeyed, he said. At the end of his long life, Hudson Taylor could declare that the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him at prayer. The battle is the Lord's and he will conquer. We may fail. We do fail continually. But he never fails. The pioneer missionaries of the 19th century were inspired by a most positive and optimistic faith. They were absolutely convinced that the Lord, who gave the Great Commission, would ensure that it would be fulfilled. The will of God will never lead you where the grace of God cannot keep you. When, after 7 years of laboring in China, Robert Morrison saw the first Chinese convert, he wrote, "May he be the first fruits of a great harvest, one of millions who shall believe and be saved." Now, what did this first Protestant missionary to China say when he just got one convert out of 7 years' work? He'll be the first fruits of millions. Today, there are over 100 million believers in China. His faith has been vindicated. The seed that's been sown is producing 100 millionfold. Scotland's first foreign missionary, Alexander Duff, wrote, "Oh, what promises are ours, if we only had faith to grasp them. What a promise is that in the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations, and behold, I am with you, even to the end of the world. We go forth amongst the hundreds of millions of the nations. We find gigantic systems of idolatry and superstition, consolidated for thousands of years. They tower as high mountains. But what does faith say? Believe and it shall be. And if any church on earth will realize that faith, to that church will honor belong of evangelizing the nations and bringing low the mountains." When, after 7 years' labor in India, William Carey was able to witness the conversion of the first convert of his ministry, Krishnapal, from Hinduism, Carey declared, "The divine grace which changed one Indian's heart could obviously change 100,000. Again, he did not allow himself to be discouraged by only one convert after 7 years. But he looked forward to hundreds of thousands in the future. William Carey declared, "The work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country with a knowledge of Christ. We are neither working at uncertainty, nor are we afraid for the result. Christ must reign until Satan has not one inch of territory. God's cause will triumph." Here you can see the Indian government published a postage stamp with William Carey working at his translation work and with his college, Serampore College, the first Christian college in Asia, behind, honoring his educational and his writing ministry, his translation ministry. This at the 200th anniversary of the coming of William Carey to India. So this was 1993. He had arrived in 1793. How wonderful when even a Hindu government must honor a missionary's work like this. In the words of William Carey's historic sermon, which launched the modern missionary movement, "Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God." He attempted great things for God, and he expected great things from God. And you know, from the time of William Carey's launching the modern missionary movement, English speakers have made up 85% of all the missionaries in the world. In the last 200 years, Great Britain and the United States together have done more for missions. But if you take all English speakers together, it makes up 85%. By God's grace, William Carey was able to successfully campaign against the Hindu practice of suti, where widows were burned alive on the funeral pyres of their deceased husbands. Carey also ended the practice of burning lepers alive. William Carey established the first newspaper ever produced in Oriental language. He introduced the steam engine to India. He pioneered lending libraries to make knowledge available. He introduced savings banks. Why would a missionary introduce savings banks? So that the poor people would have a way of buying their own land and houses. He pioneered forest conservation 50 years before the British government introduced forestry conservation. He did it. He pioneered things. He established the first Christian college in Asia, which still is training leaders, Serampore College. He succeeded in producing and distributing over 200,000 Bibles and New Testament Gospels. He translated the full Bible into 6 languages, New Testaments and Gospels into another 30, in addition to many books and tracts. By God's grace, through the ministry of Mary Slessor, the killing of twins ceased in Nigeria. Slave trading in Calabar was eradicated. Drunkenness, killing, and witchcraft diminished. Many schools and churches were established. Most of the people of Calabar came to embrace the gospel of Christ. The first public worship service in New Zealand was conducted Christmas Day, 1814, by Samuel Marsden. So this is the 200th anniversary this year of the advent of Christianity to New Zealand. By 1845, it was reported 98% of Maoris had embraced Christianity officially. By the time John Williams had been clubbed to death and eaten by cannibals on the island of Eromonga, 1839, he had already succeeded in transforming scores of islands by the scriptures he had translated, by the schools he had established, by the churches he had built, and the many thousands of islanders he had brought to Christ. John Williams had been converted 25 years earlier by a sermon based on what is a man profited if he's to gain the whole world but lose his own soul? What can a man give in exchange for a soul? True to the verse he had heard on the night of his conversion, in 1814, John Williams found his life by losing it for Christ. Frank Patton followed in his father John Patton's footsteps. He became a missionary to the very island where his father had been forced to flee for his life 34 years before. During his ministry there, Frank was blessed to see the whole population of Tana won for Christ. They said before he came there were no Christians, when he left there were no heathen. Similarly, Robert Morrison had the joy of seeing his son, John Morrison, follow in his father's footsteps and pour out his heart and soul into the work of bringing the gospel to the people of China. All of Adoniram Judson's 5 surviving children, he had 10 children, 5 died in the field. But of the 5 surviving children, all grew up to distinguish themselves in Christian service. Robert Moffat, who translated the first complete translation of the Bible into an African language, the Tswana language, he had the joy of seeing 5 of his 7 children actively involved in missionary service. His son John Moffat established the first mission station amongst the Matabele, who I grew up amongst in Bulawayo and Matabele land, Zimbabwe. 2 of C.T. Studd's daughters, who had been born in China, came and joined him with their husbands in his Heart of Africa mission in the Congo, including Edith Buxton here. One of the many fruits of William Wilberforce's lifelong crusade against the slave trade was that Samuel Ajay Crowther, who was born in Yorubaland, 1807, the year that Great Britain abolished slave trade, Samuel Ajay Crowther became the first African bishop of the Church of England. Samuel Crowther was born in Yorubaland. At age 13, he was captured by African slavers, and he was sold to Portuguese traders for transport across the Atlantic. But he was rescued by a British naval squadron, 1822, and put ashore at Freetown. From 1809, the British government mobilized its navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. For a century, the Royal Navy was dedicated to setting captives free, going far beyond clearing the oceans of slave ships. They boldly sailed up uncharted rivers and creeks. They stormed slave stockades, and they freed captives at every turn. These are some of the slaves set free by Royal Navy sailors in the 1800s. This is in 1893, HMS Philomel. Great Britain dedicated its resources to fighting and opposing the slave trade. The British spent millions of pounds in suppressing the slave trade and sacrificed much blood in fighting to set the captives free. The West African country of Sierra Leone was established by British evangelicals, friends of William Wilberforce, to serve as a haven for freed slaves. Britain invested vast amounts of money into developing Sierra Leone as a haven, a free and independent state where liberated slaves could settle. So it was to Sierra Leone that Samuel Crowther was taken to receive an education. There he was converted to Christ. He received his education first in Sierra Leone and later in England. About the third year of my liberation from the slavery of man, I was convinced of another worse state of slavery, that of sin and Satan. I was admitted to the visible Church of Christ here on earth as a soldier to fight manfully under his banner against spiritual enemies. In 1843, he was ordained as a Church of England minister for service with the Church Missionary Society, the CMS. Crowther was one of the leaders of a successful missionary venture that took him and several other former slaves back to their native Yoruba land, where vigorous Christianity soon developed. One of the first converts Samuel baptized was his own mother, who took the Christian name Hannah. As Hannah gave her child back to the Lord, receive from the Lord, given back to the Lord. So he was Samuel, she was Hannah. His language, Yoruba, became the first African language to be used by the Church of England in liturgy for worship. And Samuel Crowther did the translation. Yoruba Christians had a distinctive worship that was Protestant and evangelical in a Church of England style. Samuel Ajayi Crowther led his converts in burying or destroying their traditional charms and fetishes and idols. In 1864, Samuel Ajayi Crowther was ordained as the first African bishop of the Church of England in an overflowing Canterbury Cathedral. He was directed to undertake a mission along the Niger River, which was to follow up on the Niger expedition of 1841, which was led by William Wilberforce's successor, T. Foxlaw Buxton, an evangelical leader in Parliament and leader of the Anti-Slavery Society. His expedition up the Niger River Valley of West Africa was to overcome the ravages of the slave industry still entrenched there. Of the 145 Europeans on that expedition, 130 were struck down with malaria and 40 died. Imagine a group about the size of your staff and students at this campus. Imagine 40 dying on one mission outreach. Yet this expedition succeeded in establishing a missionary center at Fora Bay for trained slaves to evangelize West Africa. It was built on the very place where the slave market once stood, and the rafters of the roof were made almost entirely from masts of old slave ships which the Royal Navy donated to them for that purpose. Samuel Ajayi Crowther was one of the first four students to graduate from Fora Bay College, which was sub-Saharan Africa's first university. Samuel Crowther labored diligently to bring the gospel to the diverse tribes of the Niger River. He produced biblical tracts and scripture texts dealing with witchcraft and charms. He dealt with the common ground between the Quran and the scriptures and produced gospel presentations for Muslims founded entirely on Bible quotations. Crowther wrote in 1854 of his contact with King Ogara of Panda. I asked if he would like his people to be taught God's book and how to worship God as we do in the white man's country. For it was these two things together which made England great, and that would bring peace and prosperity to any country who received and embraced them. He replied that he was very desirous that war should cease, that his people might trade and be taught God's book, and he wished us many blessings. Samuel Ajayi Crowther was effective in opposing slavery and witchcraft in Islam. He won many converts to Christ amongst the Nuk and Hausa Muslims. Bishop Crowther worked effectively at indigenizing an evangelical Anglicanism, which was truly African, so successfully that today there are over 14 million Anglicans in Nigeria. which is 14 times more Anglicans in church in Nigeria every Sunday than Anglicans gathered in church in Great Britain and North America combined. Missions is the lifeblood of the church, and it's absolutely essential that our congregations and our families be presented with these and many other inspiring examples of those whom God blessed and used in such extraordinary ways. We need to read these examples and feed our minds and our souls with examples of excellence. I pray that these few selected adventures and sacrifices, exploits and pictures and achievements presented will whet your appetite to read the whole book, The Great Ascension of Missions, and to obtain more missionary biographies, and to start the lifelong habit of making time to feed body, mind and soul with what Alexander Somerville called the noblest object that can engage the enthusiasm of man, the salvation of millions. May God be pleased to enable us to expect great things from Him and to attempt great things for Him. One of those who answered the prayer was David Brainerd, missionary to the North American Indians. His journal included this prayer: "Here I am. Send me. Send me to the rough, to the savage pagans of the wilderness. Send me from all that's called comfort on earth. Send me even to death itself, if it be but in thy service and to promote thy kingdom." C.T. Studd said, "You only have one life. It will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." That's why I call it the greatest century of missions. Key dates: 1792, William Carey wrote The Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen. And so William Carey preached the sermon, attempt great things for God, expect great things from God. He wrote the book and he launched the missionary society that started the greatest century of missionary advance ever. And in 1793, William Carey sailed for India and launched the modern missionary movement, since which time English speakers have made up 85% of all the missionaries in the world. And William Carey is the father of modern missions for that reason. And not only William Carey's launch of the modern missionary movement, and today you can even find the Carey Baptist Church in Calcutta. You've got some good books in your library to read their biographies. But 1807, the slave trade was abolished by the British Parliament because of the tireless efforts of William Wilberforce and other evangelical Christians in Britain who worked extremely hard to bring an end to this vile trade and human filth and to end this disgraceful involvement of Europe in the slave trade. And so 1807, the British Parliament, by act, abolished the slave trade. And then they launched their navy to spend the rest of the 19th century interdicting slave ships and setting captives free because of the evangelical convictions and vision of William Wilberforce. Captives were set free, all slaves set free in 1833 throughout the British Empire as a result of this man's lifelong commitment. An inspiring achievement. We praise God for that. And if you've not seen the film Amazing Grace, well worth seeing on some of the actions and life and faith and faith of William Wilberforce. I'm sure this is in your library. And if you haven't had a chance to see it, I strongly advise it. Very edifying. Give you a glimpse into history. Samuel Ajay Crowther. I'm sure you've got books on him. And there's a chapter on him also in the Church History Manual as well. 1812. America's first foreign missionaries, Adoniram and Ann Judson, sail for Burma. The Golden Shores. The Golden Throne. Suffered so much. He lost his wife, Anne. His second wife, he lost also to disease in the field. 5 of his 10 children died in the field. He was imprisoned and tortured, but he persevered. And today, there are hundreds of thousands of dedicated Christians in Burma as a result of Adoniram Judson's faithful work. When he died, there were 100,000 baptized people amongst the Karen people who remain faithful to Christ to this day in this Buddhist dictatorship. Of course, there was the Napoleonic Wars, which ended in 1815, the Battle of Waterloo, one of the most important battles in the history of the world, because it ended the French threat and it established the primacy of Britain instead of France in world history. And that's why you're speaking English today, not French. And the Congress of Vienna in 1815, they redivided Europe and they abolished the slave trade. 8 powers of Europe signed the abolition of the slave trade at the Congress of Vienna in 1815. Every power in Europe except Portugal, shamefully. In 1817, Elizabeth Fry began her ministry to women in prison. Wonderful prison ministry work. 1829, suti, widow burning, was outlawed in India. They still call it Carey's Edict. This was the missionary William Carey who campaigned for the rights of women in India and brought an end to this Hindu practice. You can see some of the tribes and groups and in Africa that the Muslims raided for slaves and where the slaves were taken from West Africa, from Central Africa, and from East Africa into the Middle East and across the Indian Ocean. 1830, Charles Finney's urban revivals began. 1830, Nelson Darby, John Nelson Darby, started the Plymouth Brethren. And 1841, David Livingstone landed in Cape Town, South Africa, and began his great missionary work across the continent of Africa, opening up Africa to the gospel and bringing an end to the Islamic slave trade, exposing the slave trade in Africa. A phenomenal achievement. Walked across the continent from coast to coast, from side to side, setting thousands of captives free. 1854, Florence Nightingale sailed for Turkey and launched the first modern nursing profession during the Crimean War. Florence Nightingale, a noble woman from Britain whose legacy has saved millions of people's lives because of her absolutely revolutionary teaching on hygiene and nursing. And the modern style of nursing is based heavily on Florence Nightingale's spectacular work. The Lady with the Lamp, dedicated evangelical Christian who was called by God to start the nursing profession, which up till then was not really in existence. 1854, Hudson Taylor arrived in China and began the first truly interdenominational mission, an interdenominational faith mission, a mission where even women could join, even lay people could join. First time, he had a faith mission, interdenominational, where even women, single women could join. 1854, Charles Haddon Spurgeon became pastor in London. He's known as the Prince of Preachers, the Puritan Prince of Preachers, one of the greatest preachers of all time. Charles Spurgeon, by the way, stands as the greatest Christian author in history. Nobody has written more books, had more books in print than Charles Spurgeon. Makes him the most prolific author in history and one of the most successful preachers in all of history. He is the greatest preacher of his age. In an age of great preachers, Charles Spurgeon was the greatest. The Puritan Prince of Preachers. When Spurgeon took a text, he took it seriously and he used it to point people to Christ. And if you can get hold of his morning and evening devotions, that's one I still use frequently. Outstanding. All of his books are highly recommended. 1855, Dwight L. Moosey was converted. And this shoe salesman ended up becoming a very effective evangelist. Won many hundreds of thousands to Christ. D.L. Moody said he would not go to bed at night unless he had witnessed to one person personally that day. It didn't count if he'd spoken to thousands in a stadium. One on one. He'd sometimes get up at night and realize they haven't witnessed to one person a day. He'd been preaching, but he hadn't witnessed to one person. He puts on his dressing gown, he'd go in the streets and find somebody that he could witness to because he doesn't want to go to bed without witnessing to one new person every day. 1857, David Livingstone published Missionary Travels, which inspired a whole new generation of missionaries into Africa. He put Africa before people and he commended Africa to many missionaries who later made Africa their home and their life. He walked from coast to coast across 12 countries. Walked from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean on a continent that didn't have roads or bridges yet. One of his most famous converts, a skeptical, cynical American journalist, Henry Morton Stanley, who said that he was converted to Christ through Livingstone's example. You can see from a Muslim point of view how Islam has always been aiming to take over Africa, going from the Middle East. Can you see how we've put Africa upside down? So from a Muslim point of view, coming in to take us. And that's why you see how important it is that northern Nigeria and Sudan stop the Islamic move down the coast. So, as we look at this greatest century of missions, we look back and we can see some of the greatest names. What's happened to these names? Ha! I think they must have moved right to the end of this. I abbreviated and hit slide some things because I realized we'd run out of time on them. The names are in your books. Let me go back to what we have on there. An overview of church history. So, as we come to the end of this quick survey, let me take you on a quick summary of this last one that we've just dealt with. The greatest century of missions we've just gone through. Some of these great names. So where? Yes. Other important dates in the 19th century. 1861, the United States and the Confederate States of America, war between the states, tragic. 650,000 dead, absolutely terrible. That any country would wage war against their own population for simply wanting to be separate from them. Terrible thing. And the war between the states was actually filled with war crimes as they waged war even against civilians. It was a terrible, terrible war. The Americans lost more people in that one war than they have in all the other wars they fought combined. The American War between the States. 1865, a great thing. William Booth founded the Salvation Army, one of the great evangelistic forces, and a tremendous force for caring for the poor and needy. 1870, Pope Pius IX proclaimed the doctrine of papal infallibility, that the Pope is always right and he cannot make a mistake when he speaks ex cathedra from his throne. 1885, Charles Gordon died in Khartoum after abolishing the slave trade at the hands of the Mahdi and the Muslims, who rose up in fury because he had set the captives free. 1886, the student volunteer movement begins, mobilizing vast amounts of missionaries into the field. So the greatest names in the 19th century, in the greatest century of missions, William Carey, the missionary to India. William Wilberforce, the missionary to Parliament, who set the captives free and ended the slave trade. Adoniram Judson, America's first foreign missionary, the missionary to Burma. David Livingstone, the best friend Africa ever had, who opened up Africa to the gospel and ended the Islamic slave trade. Charles Spurgeon, the Puritan prince of preachers. D.L. Moody, the great American evangelist. Florence Nightingale, the lady with the lamp, who founded modern nursing. Hudson Taylor, the leader of the first truly interdenominational faith mission. William Booth, the one who started the Salvation Army. And we could add Mary Slessor and Samuel Ajay Crowther as well. Are there any questions at all?
Thank you very much. I want to ask about how you get this information which you have been teaching. If your answer is by reading, my question is, how do you read? How do you spend your time in reading? And if your answer is by internet, is that...
It's not. It is definitely not by the internet. Okay, I can answer you. I travel widely. I've traveled in 4 continents, 36 countries that I've done ministry in. I've traveled to others, but I've ministered in 36 countries. I've traveled to museums, monuments, battle sites, churches. I've been in the homes and the location, you know, where Ulrich Zwingli was born and where Martin Luther lived, and in the church where John Calvin preached. And I go to these places and I get the books and I try and find the manuscripts, and I specialize in getting the old books. I don't trust the new books because they have been corrupted by political correctness and propaganda. So I try and get the original. I've got the original 1600s books of the speeches and the correspondence of Oliver Cromwell. I've got original first editions of David Livingstone and of Henry Morton Stanley. I've accumulated as many first editions and old books in the original. I go and scour the old second-hand bookshops of Europe, and especially England and Ireland, where you can get some of the oldest of the old books. And I try to research original documents and the writings of the people themselves. I don't trust the internet, no. I don't trust what is said, certainly not Wikipedia. No, if you want the truth, you go to the places, you speak to the first-hand eyewitnesses. So I've done my research as much as possible in history from the books written by the people concerned, from the times concerned, not from what people thought about it centuries later. And so as I've been refining these lectures and presentations and PowerPoints, you see I've been scouring to find the pictures. Wherever possible, the original pictures or sketches that came from that time, from that century. We've got pictures that date back to the early church, and you can see, when I was speaking about the 16th century, we had mostly 16th century sketches and pictures, the 17th century pictures for the 17th century. And that's why we want to sing the hymns from those areas. So if you want knowledge, the best thing is to go back to the sources. If you want to know what the Bible teaches, you don't ask some 20th century authority. You go back and you find what does the Bible say in original manuscripts and documents, and now you know, for sure. Similarly, you don't want to find out from some university professor what Livingstone believed. You go and you read what Livingstone wrote in his time, first edition. Not some modern book that's changed it for their purposes and now got a new view. So I'm very concerned that there's a battle over history. Remember the communist leader Karl Marx said the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. So you mustn't be surprised to see a lot of history has been distorted by people who have a political agenda. And so we as Christians want to have a uniquely biblical perspective, and we don't want to bear false witness against our neighbor. We want to be sure, or our spiritual fathers in the faith, to bear false witness. We want to be sure we're getting the truth. So of course, when you study history, you must study it in the light of the scripture, but you must also try and get as far back to the sources as possible. And when you go to these places and you evaluate them, to stand in the battlefields and to stand in these cathedrals and to be in the places where this happened, and to get to those actual key places and go to the museums and examine the artifacts, for me has been fascinating. So I love history. I read history books for fun. That is my recreation, along with hiking. And I absorb a lot. So when I'm giving these lectures, you can be sure I've read dozens of books of Livingstone or on Spurgeon or any of these others. I am bringing a concentration, and I encourage you to do far more reading on your own on those subjects that most interest you. But these are some things to guide. But if you want truth, you've got to be very selective. The internet's got some good things, but it's got a lot of nonsense out there. But where possible, we try and get the originals. Now, if you go onto our website, for example, you will find, if you go onto Frontline Fellowship websites, you'll find we've got links to the David Livingstone, the Livingstone 200 web. We started a website last year, which is called Livingstone 200. And on it, we've got links to all of Livingstone's writings, every museum around the country of Livingstone, all the Livingstone websites. You can actually go on and you can find, let's see if I have got those right here. I can show you, we've literally gotten on here the different websites where you can see what Livingstone wrote, and even in his own handwriting, we've got these publications available. Yes, so, you go on, I don't seem to have that immediately on hand here, but we've got also a Livingstone 200 website, along with the Reformation one, linked there. And you can go on and get directly the manuscripts and the writings of Livingstone, or on other reformers. And so we link to the museums, the monuments, the sites, and there are sites where you can get, for example, all of Charles Spurgeon's sermons and writings. And people have scanned them, and it's an extraordinary thing to get these materials available. So there's tremendous resource available. We shouldn't use our phones and our computers and our internet for superficial things. You can get some of the real treasures of the church. So, any other questions or comments?
I've seen once a prayer money with a Catholic on Francis of Assisi. Whereby they pray, Francis of Assisi, pray for sins, something like that. Now, my question is, why do you find Francis of Assisi all the significance on the Protestants and on the Catholics?
Well, that's a good question, and I think the Roman Catholics have claimed people who I do not believe they have a right to. The Roman Catholics try and claim Patrick and Columba and Boniface as Roman Catholics, but they were evangelical, evangelistic, Bible-believing people, born-again people, and I don't see how the Catholics have a right to claim them. Similarly with Francis of Assisi. Yes, he was Catholic, but he was a protester and a reformer against the Catholic system. He protested against the corruption and the opulence of the Catholic Church by taking a vow of poverty and chastity and going out and ministering to the poorest of the poor. And even while the Catholics were fighting the Muslims, he went to preach the gospel to the Muslims. I look at Francis of Assisi and see him as a real Bible believer. And so I think Protestants can quote from him. The Roman Catholics like him because he's a bit of a mystic and a saint in their mind. But we can look at him and say, here's a person who spoke straight and he loved scripture and he wanted to bring people to Christ. So we will find there are some people where the Catholics and the Protestants will both say, they're our man. And the most obvious is Patrick. All the Catholics claim Patrick as their saint. But all the Protestants of Ireland claim Patrick as the first great evangelical missionary to Ireland. So let us not, just because the Catholics claim someone, think they're off limits for us. In many cases, they've wrapped them around with a bit of legend. And then they dress them up and make pictures of them dressed like a Catholic bishop. Whereas they didn't. Patrick was dressed as a common man. He didn't dress in his fancy dress or wear the mitres of a bishop. But they will depict him like that in the stained glass windows. So when I've studied history, I've put names here that in many Protestants' church history, they probably wouldn't mention because they think, oh, he's a Catholic. But as I read them, I say, they were not Catholics. They were evangelical, born-again people. And we Protestants must look at them and say, these are also my fathers in the faith. So, any other questions or comments? Yes.
My question has come from a very good
person.
What was the basic apostate church that was killed by the Catholic
Church? Are you talking about an Apostles' Creed? You see, we believe in one apostolic church. Well, by apostolic church, we mean the church that was originally established by the apostles. The first century church established by the apostles. So if I speak about an apostolic church, some people may think, oh, is he talking about the apostolic faith mission, the old apostles, new apostles? But no, we're talking about in the creeds, the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed. The apostolic church means the church in the book of Acts, the church of the early church fathers. When we speak about a Catholic church, one holy apostolic Catholic church, we're not referring to the Roman Catholic Church. Catholic means universal. So Roman Catholic is an oxymoron. It's contradictory. Roman is local. Catholic is universal. A Roman Catholic Church is a contradiction in terms. But we tend to let them get away with that. But if we speak about the Catholic Church, we're meaning, if we're using the creeds, the universal church, which doesn't mean the Roman Church. It means all true Christians. So sometimes they'll speak about the apostolic and Catholic Church. That's not a denomination. It's just a meaning the church founded by the apostles, meaning we accept the Apostles' Creed, the Acts of the Apostles, as the model for our church and our beliefs. And Catholic, if we use it in terms of creeds, we just mean a universal church. It doesn't mean Roman Catholic. In fact, the Reformers used to refer to the Catholics not as Catholics, but as Papists and Romanists. But we tend to the day, when we speak about Catholics, we meaning Roman Catholics. But to be accurate, we speak about Romanists or Papists or Roman Catholics. Because a Catholic, in a real sense, we could be considered Catholic in the sense that we're part of the universal church. But the Romanists have hijacked the term Catholic, and that's a pity.